My experience in 1917-18 in the Royal Flying Corps was absolutely indispensable to me when later on in 1940 I was commanding the fighter defences in the south of England, first of all covering the retreat from Dunkirk, and then throughout 1940 and especially in the during the Battle of Britain. The reason I say this is that we were again fighting the same enemy, the Germans, and I knew they were very good natural warriors, brave, well-disciplined, good fighters on the ground and in the air. I also learnt that they were slow to adapt themselves when a set plan on the ground or in the air, set plan, was thrown out of gear by weather or the enemy's surprise action. In 1926, when I was a squadron leader, I was the air staff officer to a very famous airman called Air Marshal Sir John Salmon. In 1926, I was recalled from service in Egypt to help him reform the air defences of Great Britain, which had been disbanded in 1919 after the First World War. It was based on the principle of a concentration of fighters at selected stations which had to be connected up to a central or focal point where the one commander had, by in those days, by telephone, he could dispatch and control his fighters up to the time they left the ground. And in the air, of course, at that time there was no, the radio telephones were existing in 1926, but they were very elementary. But the intention was to pass the orders from the one central commander. In 1940 I held that position as an officer, an air officer commanding 11 fighter group. The central command post issued orders by telephone to its six fighter stations for the dispatch of the squadrons, and through those fighter stations orders were issued by telephone and then radio telephone to the formation leaders in the air. All that was begun in 1926, and from 26 to 39 it was being perfected in England. At the time of Munich in 38, our radar chain, just we had a few stations covering the Thames estuary. The chain didn't cover the southeast of England. It wasn't even wide enough to protect London. But after Munich, our fighter command went on to a war footing, and we worked 7 days a week from 1938, from Munich onwards. We worked 7 days a week, a little harder than we did after the war broke out. And the radar was built up then, and we perfected it. But even when war broke out, the radar was very limited. It could give you the position of an approaching formation of aircraft. It could not give you the height. It couldn't give you the strength, better than to say 5+, and that meant from 5 to 20 aircraft. 20+ meant from 20 to 100 aircraft. 10,000 feet meant plus or minus 2,000 feet. It might be anything between 8,000 and 12,000 feet. It was the nearest they could get. However, the warning was quite essential to get our squadrons up in the air and for the control of the air raid warning system. It was quite vital. My chief, Darling, was the overall commander-in-chief. I was his operational commander. In other words, the chap that fought the squadrons, and he was the chap that provided the squadrons for me to fight with. The chief of the air staff, called Air Marshal Newell at that time, was all for agreeing to the War Office demands for squadrons, more and more squadrons to be sent to the British Expeditionary Force. Dowding saw he had no confidence in the French army, and he felt they were going to fold up in the face of the German onslaught of their armoured divisions, their armour and their Luftwaffe. And he quite rightly refused to obey the orders of the Air Ministry to send more squadrons to France, and he appealed to the War Cabinet. And he appealed to Mr. Churchill, who fortunately for us agreed not to send any more fighter squadrons to France at a time when the aerodromes were all being bombed and captured. The intelligence we have of the Luftwaffe, I think, was extremely poor, looking back now. For instance, after Dunkirk, after the evacuation of Dunkirk in June 1940, I frequently rang up the Air Ministry, the head of the intelligence department, knowing that the Battle of Britain was about to begin, and asked him for the strength and disposition of the German fighter squadrons opposite me. And I couldn't even get that basic information on which to plan my battle before it started, nor even while it was in progress. We in the 11 fighter group in the south of England, we were working feverishly, one, filling up the gaps in the pilot strength after the fighting over Dunkirk, re-equipping and retraining our new pilots to getting ready for the Battle of Britain. Further, we were extremely busy preparing alternative landing grounds. Each of my six main stations had at least one alternative, we call satellite landing ground, so that if the main aerodrome were bombed out of action, which they were later on temporarily, at times for a few hours, we could land and take off our squadrons from alternative aerodromes. We were busy clearing those and preparing them and organizing telecommunications and wireless communications for alternative operations rooms. We were extremely busy during that interim period between Dunkirk and August. It's customary to divide the battle into three phases, but really I would divide it into four. First of all, from the middle of July till the 7th of August, there was a clear offensive, a clearly defined offensive by the German Air Force against our British shipping in the south of England and in the Channel, against our naval bases and our commercial ports. And that was followed by phase two, I call it, from the 8th of August till the 18th of August, when Goering was attacking our ports and naval bases, and also he started attacking my coastal aerodromes, forward fighter aerodromes. That was followed by phase three, when the Luftwaffe concentrated for a period of 3 weeks on knocking out my main fighter aerodromes in the south and southeast of England. And that was a most critical period. And the last period was between the 8th of September and the 6th of October, when Goering concentrated his day bombers on London, the London docks, aircraft factories, and other cities in the south of England. That was really his major tactical error, because I think now that had he carried on for another week or 10 days hammering my fighter aerodromes, I think he might have had them right out of action, in which case we could have lost the battle, because we could not operate effectively from aerodromes north of London. But the most critical was phase three, that is, from the middle of August to the 7th of September. Goering made an all-out effort to destroy my aircraft on the ground, my hangars, workshops, and other installations, and all my fighter stations in the south of England. A very determined attack. Three or four times a day the raids came, and they were always after the aerodromes. At times they put places like Biggin Hill, Kinley, Hornchurch, all these were vital fighter aerodromes. At the time they were put out of action for an hour or several hours until we filled in the bomb craters and made them possible to land on. I would think that during the first week in September I was a very worried man. I was a very worried man then, because I was short of pilots. That was the thing that worried me. Frankly, I was never worried about the supply of aircraft, because a chap called Beaverbrook, was had been put in by Mr. Churchill as head of the aircraft production, and he used to ring up my house every evening at midnight and ask how many aircraft, Hurricanes and fighters had I lost, what replacements were required the next day. He used to ring up personally every night to get the score. In point of fact, long before he rang up, his staff had rung up and asked me the same questions 5 or 6 hours earlier, and they were getting on with the replacement. But the fact remains, as the commander on the front line at that time, it was very heartening to have the director of aircraft production ringing up personally every night without fail. I was never really grounded through lack of aircraft, although we were nearly grounded through lack of pilots on many occasions.
Yes.
We were short of pilots from early in the battle, owing to a bad planning on the part of the Air Ministry's training department. After the battle was over, truly won, I was sent to Flying Training Command for a year to take over the training of our fighter pilots. And the first thing I learned, to my amazement, was that the Flying Training Command had never heard throughout 1940, they'd never been told by anybody that we were desperately short of pilots. Well, that was my main problem, and the reason that I spent every afternoon from after I thought the main attacks were over, 4 or 5 o'clock, I went out to the Northolt Aerodrome every afternoon in the week and climbed into my old Hurricane and flew around some of the aerodromes every day, 7 days a week, in order to talk to the pilots, the flight commanders, squadron commanders, to see how they were standing the strain, because I was caning them, I was working them to the limit of their physical and mental capacity.
Yes.
And we were very short of reliefs.
One of the things that one always hears so often is that it was the Spitfire that won the battle. In point of fact, you had more Hurricane squadrons.
I think the proportion was 1/3 Spitfires to 2/3 Hurricanes. And therefore, I used the Spitfire having the edge on the performance of the Messerschmitt. My policy was to use the Spitfires for the attacking of the German fighter escort, their fighter cover, and to reserve the Hurricanes for attacking their bomber forces, which were lower down and less speedy and less manoeuvrable.
Yes, now Mr. Churchill came down and had a look at you at one stage, didn't he, sir?
Well, he came down a number of times. He used to come, I think he, from memory, he must have come down more than half a dozen times and sat in my operations room at Uxbridge for hours, waiting for the battle to start and watching what happened and listening to me issuing my orders. He was excellent. He never interfered or made any attempt to interfere in the conduct of operations, of course. I think he was intensely interested, and I'm sure he knew that what the consequences of winning or losing this battle. It was quite vital to the Allied cause that we should win this battle.
Well, now, what were the geographical areas of 11 Group, roughly? You had London, the great...
Oh, we covered the southeast of England from, we'll say, roughly the Wash round to just west of Portsmouth.
Mm-hmm.
It was the area that was within range of all the German fighters. That's why we had all the heavy attacks, because it was well within range of the escorting German fighters.
And had the great target in it.
Yes, at London, all the main naval docks and all a great many of the aircraft factories, and all my vital aerodromes, the forward fighter aerodromes, which were vital to the whole battle. My orders were from Dowding to fight the battle with my own 25 squadrons, and only to call on the groups on my right and left when all my forces were committed, they were all dispatched and all engaged. In point of fact, I did call on 10 Group on my right very frequently, because there were so many German attacks on Portsmouth, Southampton, the fighter aerodromes in the south of England, Tangmere, Netherwald, There were so many attacks down there that I just couldn't cover the front. When my squadrons were engaged in the southeast, I would frequently call on 10 Group 4, we'll say two squadrons, to protect Portsmouth or Southampton or a fighter aerodrome. And here I would like to record that never on one occasion throughout the 3 months of the Battle of Britain, never on one single occasion did Air Vice Marshal Brand, commanding that group, question my request. Never once did they fail to send a couple of squadrons straight to where they were asked to go, and on that, for that reason alone, they must have saved Portsmouth, Southampton, Weymouth. They must have saved them thousands of casualties. 12 Group, my other flank, had five squadrons at Duxford in the back area that wasn't being bombed. I was permitted to call on them for a couple of squadrons, or two or three squadrons, wherever I was hard pressed, and I did so. But Bader, who was the senior squadron commander at Duxford in that station at that time, and he had a theory that it was safer and better to not to send a couple of squadrons when asked and where are told to go, but to, he had a theory, better to form up his five squadrons, climb them, rendezvous, assemble them, and bring them forward as five great mass wing into the battle area. That had some advantages. From it gave a big, impressive wing, but the time taken was so great that on many occasions the aerodromes that I'd asked them to go and defend, Hornchurch and North Weald, were heavily bombed. But I will say that on the few occasions when there was a follow-on or a second or third wave attack by the Germans, and when Bader's wing ran into these German formations, mark you, after they'd been attacked by our flak crossing Kent and Essex, they'd been attacked by some 11 Group fighter squadrons forward, and the escort had been drawn off. But when Bader's big wings did run into bomber formations in the south of England, they got some very good shooting. But always after the enemy had done the damage and bombed the docks or bombed my aerodromes. Now, the position of my squadrons in 11 Group was quite different altogether to these squadrons up stationed at Duxford in a back area. Picture, my task was, first of all, Goering was attacking my fighter aerodromes with the object of knocking fighter command out of action as a preliminary to invading England. So my tasks were really three, and they were quite clear to me and to Dowding. We never even questioned or discussed them. First, I had to avoid having my pilots and my fighters' aircraft destroyed on the ground. The warning was so short in the forward aerodromes that there wasn't time to mess about dispatching two, three, four, or five squadrons before the bombs would be falling. Now, my second task was to prevent my fighter aerodromes being with their vital operations rooms, hangars, workshops, telephones, messes, and all the ground organization. My second job was to prevent these being bombed out of action, as was done in Poland, as was done in France. Thirdly, I had to inflict the maximum casualties on the German Air Force in order to wear them down so that we could prevent them obtaining air superiority over any part of England. You see, that so that to win my battle, we were fighting with our 11 Group with our backs to the wall. This wasn't a little game. We were not in a position to try out tactical theories of this and that, big wings or little wings. We were fighting for our existence and the existence of the London and the Empire. And I say now, after all these years, had I tried to adopt Baader's theories of the big wings of five squadrons, I say now, I would have lost the Battle of Britain. And this would have resulted, we know now, in an invasion by sea and by air, by Hitler, with his armored divisions, at a time where our army hadn't enough rifles to go around, leave alone tanks and anti-aircraft guns. I might well have lost the war for the Allies. When I went to Malta to command the Air Force of Malta in June 1942, I found Malta was being bombed three or four times a day, every day, 7 days a week, and I was having fighters and airmen destroyed on the ground, because the system in vogue there was what they call the big wing theory. They were trying to dispatch the Spitfire squadrons south of the island and form them up into big wings before they brought them in to intercept the German bombers and fighter escort. The result was that the German bombers were never being intercepted before they'd bombed the docks or my aerodromes. I immediately changed the tactics to the same as 11 group. That is, I dispatched the squadron singly or in wings of two squadrons. I sent them forward to intercept the German bombers over the sea before they could drop their bombs. We broke up their formations before they ever reached Malta. And I boast that within 2 weeks of arriving in Malta, my squadrons completely put a stop to daylight raids over Malta within 2 weeks without any additional strength. That was just an alteration of tactics. We did the same in Burma when I was out in Burma in Southeast Asia. And finally, the Germans themselves in 1944, they started by using massed wings of fighters to intercept the Allied bombers. It was quite ineffectual, and they had to resort to small wings of 24 at the most, 12 to 24 fighters, in order to stop, or rather to intercept and attack the American Air Force. But there have been, you'll say, well, why has there been all this controversy about Baader's big wings? I'll let you into a secret I've never mentioned before publicly. In October 1940, long after the Battle of Britain had been won, some two or three air marshals at the Air Ministry, who envied Dowding and wanted his job, criticized the fighter tactics used during the Battle of Britain. That was my tactics as the senior operational commander, and made out that I should have employed the big wings advocated by Squadron Leader Baader, supported by his Air Vice Marshal, who wanted my command. This was used as a very specious argument to criticize Dowding. The Prime Minister was told that Dowding was a tired man and he was removed from the command and given a sinecure of a job in America. And as they got rid of, as Dowding was removed, I as his senior operational commander also had to be removed. So I went to a training command for a year, and I had to wait till 1942, and I was commanding the Air Force in Malta, to prove again that my tactics of small wings were successful and more effective than big wings. The story is as simple as that. It was just a little intrigue. They go on in all services in war, and this was really rather a bigger one than usual.